I also grew up in apartments, and so the idea of small living was not new to me. It's something I feel really comfortable with. I don't love big houses. I never saw myself living in a huge house. It was never a goal of mine to live in a mansion or to have, you know, a giant, crazy, architecturally designed house. So it felt like home quite quickly, I think, because of the size and because of the intimacy a small house creates just by existing.
Welcome to Imprint, a podcast about creating a home and life you love. I'm Natalie Walton, an interior designer, stylist, and best-selling author focused on an holistic approach to homes. Each week, I'm sharing insights and interviews about the creative process to help you enhance both your interiors and well-being, as well as provide you with the tools and resources to make considered and sustainable choices with all that you create. Hello, everyone. Welcome to Imprint. Today, I'm excited to share my conversation with Holly McCauley, who is a designer. She is a designer of books, a graphic designer. She is the designer behind my books, Style, and also Home by the Sea. I have a great admiration for her. We've worked on some other projects as well, and she has a very calm and grounding presence, even though she is actually quite busy in various creative projects, including running a gallery called Yeah Nice Gallery, which is in the Byron Bay region. We talk about simple living, small living. We talk about, you know, being persistent and know the benefits of deadlines, all the things that I think that has really been the key to her success. And I hope that you enjoy learning more about Holly as much as I did. Hello, Holly. I am so excited to speak to you today. It feels like a little bit of a treat because we've sort of had the opportunity to work together a couple of times over the past couple of years on my books. And I would love to actually know a little bit more of your backstory. So often where I like to start is just to kind of get a little bit of a sense of your environment growing up and how that might have infused your creativity and the sort of the path that you've gone on since then. So I should say, welcome to the podcast. And if you could just share a little bit about your backstory for those kind of early years, and did you have any sense then that you would go on the journey that you've been on?
Hi, Natalie. Thank you so much for having me on the podcast. I'm very out of my comfort zone. So thank you for pushing me to come and talk to you. Well, not pushing, but I'm looking forward to having a chat. And as you mentioned, we've worked together in the past. So it's really nice to sit down and actually have a chat, not about books and work and all the little nitty gritty things. So I guess my upbringing was quite alternative. I grew up with two very creative parents who I think their worst nightmare would have been me not ending up in a creative field. So I definitely think that was inadvertently put on me from day one, not complaining at all. I grew up in Sydney, and I guess my parents and their friends and who they surrounded themselves with were not your typical sort of, you know, suburban families. There was a lot of creativity from an early age just in the way we lived and the people who came in and out of our home. So I really think that having the parents that I had, I was always going to end up doing something a little different. I wasn't going to end up being a banker or an accountant.
Do you have any siblings?
I have a very mixed family. So I have two older brothers and an older sister from my dad's first marriage. And then I'm an only child for my mum. And my parents split up when I was really little. So I guess I grew up very adapting to lots of different situations, which has really been a blessing not a curse as I thought it was when I was a kid. So it's made me pretty resilient.
Yeah, I was just curious to see, you know, whether you're, because sometimes people can rebel, you know, and they can kind of go the other way. They can go against what, you know, all that creativity, because I've heard of that happening as well. So what about...
One or the other.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess then if you're presented with, you know, this world of creativity, you could have kind of gone down any path in some ways. I'm curious, when you were in those sort of more formative years, you know, at high school, and when you're starting to think about what you might want to do when you kind of leave school, what were your thoughts then about what you wanted to do, and how has that evolved and changed, you know, since then?
Well, I guess that's where I did kind of rebel against my parents in a way, in that I didn't want to be, you know, you think of being creative, you want to be an artist or you want to be a musician or something like that. Whereas I, from a very early age, knew that I wanted to have a very practical career, but still be creative. I wanted to, from very young, I knew that I needed to support myself from as soon as I could. I really felt the need to have a creative career, but which was also a trade. So that's what really pushed me in the direction of design. In high school, I was really into art. It was my favorite subject. I was into art history and all that stuff. I was massively into photography. And I think just being raised the way I was raised, I was constantly thinking, you know, how am I going to turn this into a life for myself? And once I got to those decision-making years, it pointed me in the direction of choosing graphic design, because I saw it really as a trade that I could use straight away, which I know it's like very, I was never really good at visual arts, I suppose. I was never going to be a painter or anything like that, but I really just wanted to give myself something that would really, really be a steadfast way for me to look after myself as I sort of grew.
Yeah, no, I can relate to that a lot. I mean, because for me, I love reading. I wouldn't say like I love writing. I mean, I always wrote in journals, but I knew that I love books. I love books so much, but I similarly had that thing of wanting to be kind of practical. Like I knew that I had to find some kind of practical outlet for it. So for me, I went into journalism. And that was, in some ways, I mean, I did go to uni and I did actually ended up doing my master's in journalism, not that I necessarily needed to do that, but it was like that practical application of being a writer, because I just couldn't get my head around how could I live as just an author, you know?
I totally agree. And that's exactly where I'm coming from. And I saw the need from a really early age, like I need to support myself as soon as I can. And although maybe it would be lovely to dabble in this and that, I was like always being quite a practical child and a practical adult, as it turns out. So I was really, and I guess that was something I'm super grateful, is like the foresight I had at a young age to really just sort of stick with it. And I run an art gallery now and I'm all for artists being artists, but I just think there are so many, like you said, different facets of creativity, and I really wanted to hone in the skills that I had to really make it a practical thing for me.
And so can you just share then, like when you left school, did you go to college, or did you kind of go to like somewhere where you learned graphic design, or were you more learning on the job? And what were some of those early kind of career? How did you end up? Because I know that you ended up in book publishing, but, you know, how did you get to that point?
Yeah, so straight out of high school, I applied for uni and got into UTS doing a visual communications course, which is kind of like you end up being doing graphic design, but it's quite a broad degree where you start off in your first year doing lots of different things, kind of like art school, but for more of like an applied design outcome. So instead of like in art school, you'd do, you know, a bit of painting, a bit of photography, a bit of printmaking, a bit of weaving. So for this course in our first year, we did, we did a bit of web design, a bit of animation, a lot of typography. We did a lot of hands-on stuff like screen printing and lino printing and all that, which was really great. And there was also like quite a heavy focus on design history, which I found super interesting. And, you know, sort of diving into those really important schools like Bauhaus and, you know, really learning all that practical stuff, which you don't get in high school. I feel like in high school, at least when I was at school, you know, you focus a lot on the classics. And, you know, this was really opened my eyes to a world beyond the fine arts, I suppose. And, you know, it really stuck with me.
Yeah. And so then how did you then get into book publishing? Was that sort of one of your early jobs?
It actually, or kind of, I had always, after a couple of years at uni, I really discovered that my love of design was something that was going to marry images and typography together. And this was at a time, this was a while ago that I was at uni, but there was a big print magazine culture at the time. This is like the mid-2000s, I guess. So there was a lot of a return back to manual printmaking, manual bookbinding, creating zines, paste ups, all that kind of stuff was like big, not necessarily in the curriculum that I was studying, but amongst my peers, everyone was doing that kind of thing. And I just realized, you know, I'm not into web design, I'm not into animation, which a lot of people I went to uni with were into that. I was really into print publication. And I just fell in love with like paper stocks and typography and all that stuff. And I, straight out of uni, I managed to get my first job was working as the creative assistant at Frankie Magazine, which is like the dream job when you're 21 and you're straight out of design school. So, I worked under two amazing women, Lou Bannister and Lara Burke, who now run Lunch Lady Magazine. So they really gave me my baptism into all things print. And I worked with them for ages, it's ages when you're in your early 20s, maybe 4 years. And then when they left the magazine, I also left. And I just by chance was offered, maybe 6 months after quitting Frankie, which was all I knew, I was offered a maternity cover contract through a friend of a friend of a friend at Penguin in Sydney. And I was living up in Byron at the time, and my partner and I were just like, you know what, we'll just give it a go. We'll move back to Sydney and you can do this book design job because it sounds like a dream and something you'd be really good at. So I guess that was my first introduction. It just came upon me. I didn't actively look it out, but it kind of did feel like, in terms of the practical craft of you know, laying out publications, was the next step was from magazines to go to books.
Yeah, no, completely. So what were some of the big lessons that you learnt in that time of book publishing? Because, and even just in, you know, relation to graphic design in general, because I think that so many of us these days have to have some kind of touch point with graphic design, and it could be our website or, you know, even things like stories on Instagram. You know, there's so many different elements that we have, I think, more and more access to this now. A lot of people who listen to this podcast are either interior designers or work in that kind of world and probably have to put mood boards together. So what can you share that are sort of some of the foundations, I guess, or some tips that you really sort of, when you're designing, you sort of, this is what you're trying to achieve. And I know that it obviously will depend brief to brief, but are there some kind of core principles or things that you kind of come back to or remind yourself of when you are designing whatever it is?
Yeah, I think first and foremost, the design principle that I follow always and always have since those early days is that form follows function, which is a classic idea in many facets of the arts and design. So essentially, you know, you need to convey the message that you're trying to convey. And then all the visuals, all the aesthetics come after that. So I think that the place in which so many people can get muddled is that there's so much focus on the end result, you know, the end look of something. But if it doesn't form its function, it essentially doesn't work. So I think that and because I do this every day, I never think back. So it's interesting you've asked me this because it's forced me to kind of explain how you do that in terms of a process from start to end. But I think that you need to really decide what it is that you're trying to achieve and what is the function of the piece of design that you're working on, and then you kind of work backwards from there. So I think a lot of people may have this beautiful idea of an outcome that they want to achieve, but if it doesn't come back to the reason why it was made, then I feel like it doesn't need to exist.
Yeah. So let's take the example of maybe, say, a website. You know, if somebody is, or a logo, whichever, you know, you feel is easier to explain. You know, if you're trying to design one of those kind of things, what are some of the, I don't know, I guess, like, questions that you should ask yourself, or the things that you should try and avoid? You know, can you kind of give a bit of an example?
Yeah, it all really comes down to very, very simple things like legibility. Can it be read? You might have something in your mind like, oh, I want my logo to be really, extravagant and have a lot of elements going on. But at the end of the day, if someone viewing your logo for the first time can't decipher what it is that you do, then it's an unsuccessful piece of design. I've also always thought, like, always followed the idea, and I feel like this is particularly something purely because of the time that I studied, like the design trends of when I was like really sort of cutting my teeth, is that less is more. White space is always your friend. And I feel like that's something that's really, you know, a message can get really clouded if there's too much going on. But in the same thought, you can still have a very comprehensive, bold, graphic, colorful piece of design that tells your story without the design getting in the way, I suppose.
Yeah, no, I think they're really, really good principles to keep in mind, because, I mean, when you said that about, you know, the less is more, and I mean, I try and embrace that in so many areas of my life, but I think that I kind of came from a magazine background where it was quite a busy magazine. You know, it was always about, like, let's put as many layers as, you know, badges, yes, you know, straps, all of that kind of stuff on.
And I came from like the complete other end of the scale with like a really arty indie magazine where it was, oh, the more white space, the better, the less ads, the better.
Yeah. And so I had to kind of really sort of teach myself to pare that back. But I can see the same principle applies when you're creating interiors too. You know, like, you need to have that negative space so that you can actually
definitely
take in what you're looking at. So yeah, I think that's really helpful. So now tell me about, you also are a co-owner of a gallery in the Byron area called Yeah Nice Gallery. That's right, isn't it? Yeah Nice?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
So tell me how that came about, and I'd love to know, you know, why you decided to do that, and how you kind of juggle all the things. I think I definitely, one of the questions I thought I have to ask Holly about this is, I feel like you have such a calm presence with yourself, and yet I know you do a lot of things, and that's something that I really admire about you, is that, you know, you've got lots of different projects on the go, but you never seem flustered. You never seem stressed. So you're going to share.
That's such a compliment.
You're going to share your secret. So tell us about Yeah Nice and how you managed to do all the things.
So Yeah Nice came about, I co-own the gallery with one of my best friends, Geordie, who's a visual artist herself. And we had always spoken about how cool would it be to open a shop or to have a space where we could do cool stuff. We didn't even know what it would look like. So The idea for the gallery came about just over a few glasses of wine, maybe a few bottles, of thinking, you know, that we really felt in Byron there was a gap in the art scene here after a few other galleries had closed down for embracing contemporary emerging art that was accessible, beautiful, and approachable. So the complete opposite to a highbrow gallery or an institution, but it needed to have the caliber of art had to be high, but the vibe had to be loose and fun. So it just happened that a space came up in Mullum, down in the old industrial estate. Friends of ours were giving up a space. It was in an old banana packing shed at the back of Mullum, almost looked like a demountable with a roller door. And so we jumped at the chance to just give it a go. The rent was super cheap. So we thought, you know, we put in a few hundred bucks each, you know, do it for a month. And if it fails, then we can just say it was something fun we did for a month. So there was no, I think the whole reason that we were able to make the gallery happen was because it was very non-committal. We didn't have to take out a business loan. We didn't need a lot of inventory. We didn't need all the big adult stuff that comes along usually with opening a business. So we just thought we'd do it for our friends, for the community, and see what happened. So this is in 2018, towards the end, and we just got keys to the old banana packing shed. We painted the roller door pink. We painted the inside, and then we got together our first group show, which was just a big mix of friends, people in that local area, people who we had worked with before, come crossed paths with, and it turned out to be something that the community really embraced and loved, and it was a hit, the first show. And so we just kept rolling with it, and we just had the mentality of let's just do it until it doesn't work anymore. And we just had our little formula of doing one show a month, and it worked really well. The old gallery didn't have any foot traffic, so it was, we kind of said we were by appointment only, but we were never there and no one ever made an appointment. But we would just throw these really fun opening nights once a month on a Friday night where people would come, drink beers, have hot dogs, talk, buy art or not buy art, or just like it turned out to be a really great place to gather. And then it's just sort of snowballed from there. We were able to get a lease on a new space in the Byron Industrial Estate just because we felt like the caliber of art was amazing and the space was quirky and grungy, but we just felt we needed to step it up a notch so that we could get foot traffic, so that we could have bigger pieces in scale, so that we could host events if we needed to, and just to feel like it was a little bit more serious than just having a fun party once a month. So we're now located in the Byron Industrial Estate, when we've been there since 2020, and our formula is still exactly the same. We just host one show a month or so. We have a fun opening night on the Friday. People drink beer, people come and look at art. And we've just, it's worked because Geordie and I both really wanted to have our own something that was outside of our 9-to-5 jobs. And we also both had an issue with, Geordie is an amazing artist and she does that in her own right. But there was nothing that we thought we could make together in terms of like a product or something that we would want to sell to people. And there's also, you know, both of us had a really conscious thought that we don't want to make more stuff to put out in the world purely just to, you know, make money. So it's just become this perfect business model for us where we can support artists, we can provide a safe, fun space for people to come if they want to come and look at art, to not feel pressure to buy, to not feel like they're out of place. We have such a wide range of clientele, from people who are collectors who will now buy something from us, multiple times a year from different artists, and they're on the phone to us before shows open just to try and get a sneak peek and put a deposit on a piece no matter what the price. And then there are other people in the community who are friends, acquaintances, not friends, who maybe have saved up for 3 or 4 years to buy their first piece of art, and it's the most thought out big decision that they've ever made. And we're so glad that we can cater to that as well. So it really has become this like perfect little combination of all the things that we believe in and our values kind of, you know, it all aligns with our values, and it aligns with Geordie being a practicing artist. It allows me, who I appreciate art so much, but I'm not an artist. I'm not, you know, hands-on like that, but I can surround myself in art, and then we can in turn support artists and give them a place to, you know, to show their wares.
Yeah, I have to ask in relation to that, I think that art is something, I mean, I've always loved art, but I think that it's something that a lot of people struggle with. They want to buy art, but they're worried that, you know, they'll buy something that they regret buying it, or, you know, because it often can be a bit of an investment. What do you think about that? What are your thoughts on the type of art that you should buy for your home, and how to get it right so that you're sort of not, you know, a couple of years down the track feeling like you regret that, you know, like, yeah, it doesn't really, like, that was kind of who I was then, but it's not really who I am now.
Totally. Well, I think as well, art can be so intimidating because the way it kind of is now, there's these big institutions, then there's these like very highbrow private galleries where pieces of work, you know, they start within the tens of thousands of dollars. And then there's also with like fast, cheap production, there's a lot of like poster places where you can buy reproductions and all that. And I'd like to think that we sit in the middle ground where we're encouraging people to learn the story behind the artist and where they've come from. And so with our like small sort of intimate space, we can allow for that to happen with artist talks and all that kind of jazz that comes with it. And then I think for your question about how do you know whether an artwork is for you, I think you have to, it really is a gut feeling, and potentially it is less to do with the piece of art, and maybe it's more to do with the artist and their story and the story behind the artwork. I really would encourage people who are new to collecting art to really do their research into where the artist has come from, what their story is, what their background is. And as soon as you know that, each piece is going to have so much more meaning to you. And I think that they, like, a work will it sounds so cliche, but it will speak to you, and it will, you know, it'll have like an impact on you when you look at it. And I think that it is a really, you know, big decision if you're spending like a few grand on a piece of art, but you really just go with your gut and avoid trends. If there's one artist that you love, you can own multiple pieces by them, which is always something that's really great. Like, you don't have to always be on the lookout for this, like, the hot new next artist. Like, if there's an artist that's been around for a while and you kind of follow them and you love what they're about, maybe it is time to invest in someone like that.
Yeah, no, I think that is such a good and kind of powerful example, you know, powerful message to share about art, because I think, you know, sort of saying that to really connect with it, so it's not just a visual thing that you're adding to your home, but it's actually a meaningful object. You know, I talk about this a lot with the things that we have in our homes, and, you know, that you want to look around and know the story behind all the pieces. And I think when you do, I think you're actually less likely to tire of it. You know, you're less likely to sort of lose that connection because it's actually deeper than a surface connection. So, yeah, I think that's a beautiful message to share. Now, let's get to this, how you manage to stay calm doing all the things that you do.
surface level calm. Maybe I've really honed in on the surface level calm.
Well, like I said, you certainly seem it very much to me. You know, you don't get flustered. And I know that you have a lot of projects on the go. Excuse me. You've got obviously the gallery. You do freelance work. I mean, you still do book design. You know, you obviously worked on my books. I know that you work with some local brands as well. And you've got, you know, two children and all of that. So, I mean, I often actually ask people how you manage your days, how you manage your time, like what works for you? What do you find works for you so that you can actually do all the things that you do?
I maybe look like I've got it all together, but I'm not sure if I do. There's definitely, I've always had lots of things on the go, and I feel like I like to be busy. I like to feel like it's kind of that old school mentality of like, I want to feel like I'm doing stuff. Like I'm not one to be idle, which I wish I could be more like that, but I like to be doing stuff. And so I think I often complain about being too busy, but then I think if you took some projects off my plate, I'd complain that I was bored. So I think for me, just being, I'm pretty practical. I'm pretty like no nonsense, and I just have to structure my week around my work and deadlines and my kids. And that's always been something that if I know what's coming, then I can be prepared for it. I, you know, always feel like there's an unfinished job, so I'm probably not the best at switching off. But I think I've been able to do it with my partner being supportive. We both lead busy lives, and he's supportive of me being busy, and he's supportive of sharing the load with our kids. So I'm really lucky in the fact that I still get to do all the things that I love to do and still, you know, do the family stuff. And like I said, if you told me that, you know, I could have a, you know, all the projects were cancelled for the rest of the year, for a moment I'd be really excited, but then give me like 2 weeks in, I'd be twiddling my thumbs and calling you saying, give me my projects back. So I think that just, and having worked, I think from, I started working when I was 14, like casual jobs, and I haven't stopped since. And I feel like it definitely early days having kids, it was tricky, and I didn't stop and I kept working and I burnt out. But now I feel like my kids are that little bit older, and I've just honed in on getting the balance right. And I would rather, you know, spend a whole day with my kids and then work really late into the night to get stuff done.
Yeah. Because I know that I see you, you know, in Bangalore walking your daughters to school, and, you know, you definitely, you know, you're there and you're present with your kids and, you know, doing different things around Bangalore. And, but I know obviously, yes, you still work, you know, other times. And I think the impression that I get, and tell me if I'm wrong, is I feel like you don't sweat the small stuff. Would you say that's accurate?
I'd like to think so. I definitely have my moments, but I think that I just, and I also have the mindset of like, it has to be done. So just do it. No matter if that's walking your kids to school, yeah, you've got to get them to school on time. So just do it. You've got a deadline that's approaching. Yeah, you've just got to get it done before the deadline, and you just do what you need to do to get it done. And everything, you know, if you've got lots of things on the go, that time will pass, you'll get a downtime. And that's all sort of part of the ebbs and flows. And I think that since having kids, I definitely changed up my working life. So I was working 9 to 5, 5 days a week since my first job out of uni. And then I kind of went to part-time when I had Della working only a couple of days a week. And it was a real juggle trying to, you know, earn enough money to make ends meet and work the jobs I wanted to work and then look after the kids. But now I just feel like, and if I had told myself this 10 years ago, that I would have a career where a few days a week I'm working at for this local brand. Another few days I'm sitting in an art gallery that I own with my best friend, and I have projects that allow me to work around my kids. I would have said, like, that's not possible. So I think that, and it's just fallen in my lap that way after, like, yeah, a lot of years of working really hard. I've somehow, like, curated my working life to be very fluid, and I'm not sitting in the same place 5 days a week, which I had done, and I enjoyed that. But it's this season of my life now is I'm in a place where I can, you know, float around. I can have a meeting here. I can, you know, go into the gallery late if I want to walk my kid to school, and to have that flexibility. It's been a long time coming to have that flexibility, but I think that's really made my life a lot easier and allowed me to keep doing the things I love doing.
Yeah, I think you're a little bit like me in that sense as well. It's, I think we both come from that magazine background where you constantly have a deadline, and so you know that you can't procrastinate, like you can't.
Yes, and you, like, know, if it's not, if off. You don't do it, no one's doing it for you. Yeah. And then you're done.
Yeah.
And so there's no, and I think I still, like, I think that's been actually probably an amazing lesson, and it set me well for now. And yeah, because if you don't do it, no one's doing it for you. And I think that that's how I live my life probably. And maybe I expected to bit too much from other people to be more like that.
But I think that it just, it's really, yeah, it's really powerful in the sense that, you know, if you don't get it done, then that magazine doesn't go to press. Like, it has to go to press. So you've got to do what you've got to do to
exactly.
get it to press.
Exactly, yes, yes.
Yeah, I think that's really helped me with so many projects as well. And I want to ask you about, so we, like I said, you designed my book style and you did it so beautifully. Lots of negative white space in that. It's beautiful.
Yes.
and also my most recent book, which is Home by the Sea, which is some of the homes in our local region, and including, you know, your home is in there as well. And I want to ask you about that, because that home, now you've recently moved, but that home was your home for a very long time. It was a very small home. And I think that I just love what you, how you went about creating it, and that you did, you know, you didn't let that put you off the size of it. Like, you really made the most of that space. And I would love if you could just share a little bit about the story of creating that home and designing small spaces, and how you did make the most of that home.
Yeah, so we bought the home about 7 years ago, and it was my partner and I, it was our first home purchase, and it was a very big deal. And the home was literally the cheapest one on the market. And classic story of, like, buy the worst house on the best street. And we didn't know it at the time, but we bought in Bangalore, and it really, like, it was a really smart decision that we made all those years ago. When we purchased the house, it was just a fibro shack. The internal space was 60 meters squared, so really small, but it had this great layout. I don't know how they did it, but it did not feel like 60 meters squared. It was really open, aesthetically horrible, but we knew, you know, we knew what we could afford, so we bought the cheapest house, and we just wanted to kind of, we were ready to make our little home with whatever we could. You know, so I guess the story behind the home is that it started off really horrible, and we made it really nice over 7 years. So we did, like, a 7 year renovation, and we didn't have a renovation budget. So the way that the house slowly improved aesthetically over the years were, each paycheck we'd buy a few lengths of decking. We might buy, you know, a tin of paint, and my partner did most of the hard yakka himself, which obviously made it doable for us. So I think that the way we went about it was, we just wanted to make a home that felt homely, that felt easy and suited the climate. We lived, it's a really warm area. There was really thick carpet, so that was the first thing to go. And we just really chipped away at it, is, like, the only, the best way I can describe the transformation of our home was chipping away really slowly, really laboriously. We didn't really have a design aesthetic that we wanted to create for our home. We didn't have that luxury to say, you know, we didn't create mood boards, we didn't, you know, consult designers, we didn't talk to architects, we literally just did what we could afford to do to make our home feel nice for us. So I was talking to my brother-in-law recently, and he said, he's an architect, and he said, the less money you have, the easier your decisions, which now I think back and I'm like, oh, 100%. We didn't make any decisions. We just did what we could do, which, you know, we did ply cabinetry. There was a concrete slab under the carpet, which my partner hand polished with a grinder. There was a lot of bush out the front, so we just chipped away at that and added a deck, which totally transformed the house straight away. We bought some wooden bifold doors off Gumtree to replace the aluminium warped sliding doors that went onto the deck. There was no real kitchen to start with, so we had a bit of a blank canvas for that one. But I also grew up in apartments, and so the idea of small living was not new to me. It's something I feel really comfortable with. I don't love big houses. I never saw myself living in a huge house. It's never was never a goal of mine to live in a mansion or to have, you know, a giant, crazy, architecturally designed house. So it felt like home quite quickly, I think, because of the size and because of the intimacy a small house creates just by existing. And so I don't have any like tips on how to live small, except just to like, I guess it's ingrained in me to live small. So it didn't feel like too much of an adjustment. But a lot of white paint helps.
It always helps.
Yeah.
And what I think that is beautiful, you know, we did a story for Imprint Journal on your home as well, and how so much of that, you know, you've got so many meaningful things in your home as well, like art from friends and all of those things. And I think they all help. But I want to ask, you know, were you, because I'm incredibly impatient and it's something that I'm working on, but over those 7 years, were you sort of patient about it and you just thought, you know, like it will happen when it happens? Or, you know, how did you kind of tackle that side of things?
I think there were definitely moments of feeling really impatient about things not being done, like really practical things like kitchen and plumbing and tiling and stuff, which all my partner all did himself pretty much, which is, I'm so lucky for that. But I think the joy of us being able to even buy a house when we thought maybe that was never something we were going to do, that outweighs the impatience of making it perfect. I think we were just so happy to have this little slice of something that was ours. And, you know, we did end up flipping it completely, but it was never like we bought the house to renovate, to sell, to flip, to, you know, turn a profit or anything. So it really, and I think as well, when you're in it and there was no deadline for us, like unlike a new build or a big renovation where you're moving out, like we were living in it every day. Nick was tinkering away at things. So it never felt, I think maybe if we had a deadline or if we had to move out for months on end in order to get things done, I would have really felt that impatience and felt like a bit edgy about it. But because it was just a really slow burn, it didn't feel like it was weighing on me, it not being perfect from day one.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So before we get to sort of our last little questions that I like to ask everyone, I do just also want to ask you about Instagram and all of that, because, you know, I think it's something that so many of us, you know, we have to use in some capacity for work, whether, you know, with you, whether it's for your design work, whether it's for the gallery. And, you know, it's such an important tool for marketing and connecting with like-minded people. But, you know, obviously there's the flip side of it, which we all know too well. How do you choose to show up on Instagram? What do you find works well for you? And I would just, yeah, I thought it could be helpful if you can share a little bit of an insight into your relationship with it.
Yeah, I think I tried promoting my design work on Instagram a few years ago, and it just felt weird and didn't work for me. I didn't have any real strategy behind it. And I think, like, coming in when Instagram first started, it was just like, you know, be around your friends and catch up, and it was social, whereas now it's very, very business minded. So I think I just wear two hats, I guess, when I'm on Instagram. Like, I really still enjoy it and love it for looking at beautiful imagery, for inspiration, for seeing my friends and family who I don't see often. And even the ones I see often, like, I really like that social side to it. And then I think I wear another hat when I run the Instagram for our gallery, which is, of course, more business minded, but it also is less personal, which I feel is like a really good thing. And we're lucky, Jordy and I, in the fact that our the gallery it's not about us. Like, we never have to show up on social media as ourselves. It's always about the artist. It's always about the works that we have in here. It's always about what's happening, and when it's like about promoting in real life gatherings, which I think is really good. So I think I would struggle more with it if I had to be more self-promoting on Instagram. But it's a funny world that everything weighs on it. But we found it really helpful with the gallery because we are hosting live events, and because we want people to come, and we want to spread word about, you know, we sell works over Instagram, which is amazing, but that's not its sole purpose for us. It's more about letting people know what's happening in our space physically. And I feel like it also gives people who don't live locally, like, we like to give them a bit of an insight as to what's going on. So I think I would struggle more with it if I was selling product, or, you know, or if I was promoting myself as a designer on there. But at the moment, the relationship with Instagram seems fine.
And is that what your sort of main, I guess, marketing strategy, you know, for want of a better word, is? I mean, I guess a lot of it is probably word of mouth and, you know, reliance on, to some degree, of the artists themselves to promote their exhibition at your gallery. But, you know, how do you kind of get people in the gallery? You know, what is your kind of your strategy with that?
Yeah, it is. I think it's beneficial that we live in a small town and that everyone knows everyone, and everyone knows what everyone else is doing on a Friday night. So that really helps. I think we would have to change the business model if we were in a big city. It works that people just walk past and we can tell them what's happening, and then they tell 10 friends, and then there's 20 extra people at the next opening. I guess we don't really have a marketing strategy, but all we do rely heavily on social media just to get the word out, which annoys me, but it's also so convenient. When we first started in Mullum, before anyone knew who we did a lot of like posters and signage and, you know, mail drops and more of like guerrilla marketing, I guess, which really worked at the time. But now we feel like we've got a really solid, supportive customer base, and not just customers who buy work, but there's people who just show up to the shows every month, and just because they love looking at the art, and we love that. Like, that's not a monetary transaction, but it works really well for us. So I guess we'll just keep doing that till Instagram crashes and dies, and then we'll have to rethink it.
Sorry, just one last question on that, because obviously, you know, it's one thing to kind of have this dream of having a kind of creative business, whether it's a gallery, whether it's a shop, whatever that is. And another thing to kind of actually either make a living from that, or, you know, make it financially viable. What are some of the lessons? Because I'm sure that you two have learned, you know, some valuable lessons on your journey. I mean, you're quite a few years into it now. What are some of the lessons specifically in relation to sort of running that type of creative business that you've learned?
Yeah, well, let me start off by saying we both still have day jobs, and the gallery is still very much a passion project for us. It's not quite paying all the bills just yet, but our biggest, not lesson learned, but I guess piece of advice is outsource. if you can't do it, pay someone else to do it. And we weren't in the position to do that until recently, but we have like an amazing bookkeeper. Just know what your strengths are and what your business partner's strengths are and divide and conquer. And then wherever there are gaps, outsource.
Yeah, that's such good advice. All right, we'll get into the last sort of little batch of questions, and I look forward to hearing your answers with these. So,
okay.
No pressure.
Yeah.
So which five words would you say best describe you?
Calm. Thank you, Natalie, for bringing that to my attention. Quiet. Happy. Relaxed, but also internally stressed.
Well, there's five.
Yes, that's enough.
What's the best lesson that you've learned? This can be in life, whatever. What's one of the best lessons you've learned?
Oh, that's so hard. But I think, and this, I think, there's so many ways to put this, but I think just going with it and trusting in the process, and things will work out some one way or another.
Yeah, I believe that too. What's your proudest achievement?
The life that I've created with my partner and our two little girls.
Yeah, beautiful. And what's been your best decision?
Taking that very first job that I was offered at Frankie Magazine, because it forced me to move to the Northern Rivers, which was never on the cards. And 13 years later, I'm still here, and it's a place where I've raised my family.
Cool. Who inspires you?
My kids.
Sweet. What about what are you passionate about?
I'm passionate about heaps of different things, but now I can't think of any. I'm passionate about supporting the arts, and I'm passionate about living simply where possible, and I'm passionate about putting as much effort as you can into relationships.
I've got another one for you, which tell me okay. If I'm right or wrong. You're passionate about Chinese food.
Oh, yeah, I'm passionate about Chinese food because I'm half Chinese, which not many people know when they look at me. But my mum is Chinese and an amazing Chinese cook. And living in a regional town, the Chinese food options are not amazing. So we got to make it ourselves, us Chinese people.
What's your favorite Chinese restaurant in Sydney? And if you have one in Melbourne, what's one in Melbourne?
Oh, I don't go to Melbourne very okay. often, but you really just can't go past Yum Cha in Sydney Chinatown or Melbourne Chinatown. I recently went to the Bob Hawk Dining Hall, and they've got an old school, new, trendy Chinese restaurant called Lucky Prawn, which was a hit.
It's good to know. We have to give a little plug to your mum. Is it Dumpling Baby?
Oh yeah, mum makes dumplings under the name Dumpling Baby, which if I told her she'd be doing this like 15 years ago, she would have laughed at me, because she has only just now embraced her Chinese culture, and now she makes dumplings for a living, and you can find them in the freezer section of your local Providor.
It's so good. Sorry, tangent. What dream do you still want to fulfill?
I really want to live overseas for at least a year, and we're doing all the things that are stopping us from doing that, like having babies and buying houses and starting businesses. So that's on the cards, and I would really, really love to do that, take my kids out of school and live and fully immerse ourselves in another country.
Where would it be? Where are some of the places on your list?
We've talked about Mexico. We've talked about Indonesia, even New Zealand, where a lot of my family live. Even though that wouldn't be much of a culture shock, it would still be a really nice change. We'll see where it goes.
It's still possible.
Yes.
What are you reading?
At the moment, I'm reading a great novel called Fortunes of the Sky. I'm a full history nerd, and it's set in the 1800s in America, and it's about a Chinese girl who's kidnapped from her home and brought to San Francisco, and it's really interesting. It's not for everyone, but I do love a really dark, serious fictional history.
Interesting. What about, I've got to ask you this actually, what is one of your favorite books from a design point of view? Or, you know, couple, if you can't think of one specifically.
Like. Yeah, one that I go purely because of the time I went to uni, the Vice photo book, I feel like sums up an era of that time, and it's one I've got on my shelf that I'll constantly go back to. And also Mike Mills Graphics and Film is a really great design reference for me and has been on my shelf for many, many years.
Cool. What are you listening to? Do you listen to podcasts or audiobooks or maybe music, whatever it is for you?
I listen to audiobooks when I'm working, and it makes me sad because I also love physical books so much. It's like I listen to the audiobook and then I've got to go buy the actual book so that I can have it on my shelf. And I listen to really nerdy history podcasts, and I also listen, we always have music playing in the house. So we've got a record player, and then my partner hates it when I put on like a Spotify mixtape because it's not the same as listening to records, but it's like the lazy option.
Cool. And finally, what piece of advice would you give to your younger self?
Stick with it.
So good. There's that. There's the patience. There's the persistence.
Yeah.
So good. Thank you so much, Holly. It has been so fun to hear a little bit more of your story. Get a little bit more of an insight into your world. I so appreciate your beautiful design work in my books, and for being a part of them. And just want to say thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me, Natalie. It was so nice to chat.
All of the links and info for this episode are at nataliewalton.com/podcast. Don't forget to subscribe so that you can get a direct download of the latest episode. And I really appreciate when you take a minute to rate and review, as well as share the love with someone you know who might benefit from this episode, or on social media. If you'd like to access a range of free resources, come visit my website, nataliewalton.com. Thank you to Jaeger Media for producing this podcast. And I would also like to acknowledge the people of the Bundjalung Nation where it was recorded, and pay my respects to elders past, present, and emerging. I look forward to connecting again soon. I'm Natalie Walton, and you've been listening to Imprint.